Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And welcome to our coverage of the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting, this year conducted virtually as AUSA Now, where our coverage is sponsored by Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS. And it is my honor to welcome to the program General Jim McConville, the 40th Chief of Staff of the United States Army. Sir, thanks so very much for joining us, and very glad to hear that you're well and COVID-free.
Well, I am, and thank you, Vago. It's great to be here with you, and appreciate the opportunity to have a little discussion.
Certainly a fascinating time. It's been a very, very busy year for the United States Army, as you've noted. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. So early in the pandemic, the question that a lot of folks were asking is what major organizations, especially the Department of Defense, but even the U.S. government, could learn from this pandemic that would be applicable to a major future war. The focus of AUSA, as you and Secretary McCarthy have said, is people first, but that winning matters. What has the Army learned over the past 7 months that would prepare it better for a future crisis, including a war?
Well, you know, one of the things that we learned right up front was that we have to respect the virus. And what I mean by that is we have to teach our soldiers how to operate in a hazardous environment. And, you know, as we look into the future, the environments that our soldiers will face, whether it's chemical, biological, or even possibly nuclear, require us to operate in a hazardous environment. So a lot of those lessons that are being learned now are very important, that we have to employ certain protocols. When do we wear our masks? How do we do social distancing? How do we take advantage of the virtual capabilities that we have? But at the end of the day, what we know is, you know, we can't telecommute to combat, that we're going to have to put soldiers on the ground, and we're going to have to work through these problem sets. And that's what I've seen our soldiers do every single day since the beginning of this pandemic. And what I've seen, too, is they've learned and got better every single day. And quite frankly, we are up to pretty much full operating capacity at our training areas, during our deployments, and really throughout the Army.
You've said that every 40 or so years, the Army needs not just modernization, but a comprehensive transformation. And you noted 1940 was transformational. It demonstrated a lot of capability at the Louisiana maneuvers, for example. And 1980 was the Big Five modernization programs hit. But there was also a remarkable amount of intellectual transformation. You held up air, land, battle as an example of that in your address. Each of those revolutions started a couple of years before those milestones. Years that we now recall. You've launched Project Convergence to try to get you there faster. And you've been focused on this issue for a number of years now, both as chief, but also as vice. Walk us through what this transformed force looks like. What are the capabilities that it needs to be able to bring to bear? And given that speed is so critical, when are we likely to see it? Is this a 2-year time horizon or a 5-year time horizon?
Yeah, let me start with what we mean by transforming the force. We're not looking for incremental improvements. I would argue that we transformed the force in 1940, came out with new doctrine, air, land, battle, came out with the Big Five weapon systems. And then what we've done is we've incrementally improved them over the last 40 years. So when we talk about transformation, what we're talking about is a new way we're going to fight. At the joint level, it's joint all-domain operations. At the Army level, it's multi-domain operations. And the way we're going to come together or converge as a force is through combined joint all-domain command and control capability, or CJADC2. And so that's the way we're going to fight. And in order to do that, we're going to develop new organizations. New organizations like the multi-domain task force that will provide long-range precision effects and long-range precision fires for the force. And when I talk about long-range precision fires, I'm talking thousands of miles. We've stood up security force assistance brigades, and they're going to allow us to build partners' capacity in the compete phase of this great power competition that goes forward. We also need to know how we're going to train in this environment. And this is an information environment. This is a cyber environment. And, you know, we'll continue to upgrade our combat training centers, which are DIRT combat training centers, but we're also going to need to train in a synthetic training environment. We're going to use virtual reality. We're going to use augmented reality. And we're going to even create cyber ranges to allow us to train in those areas that we need in this environment. And, you know, we've talked about the six modernization priorities: long-range precision fires, next-generation combat vehicle, future vertical lift, the network, air and missile defense, and soldier lethality. And all those priorities are going to help us get the weapon systems that our soldiers need to have overmatch on the battlefield. And last and probably most important is about people. We're putting in place a 21st century talent management system that's going to allow us to have the right people with the right skill sets in the right jobs.
The service has been doing an extraordinary job in cataloging those talents to get that talent management piece. And I want to talk to you about that in a couple of minutes. Are you satisfied that the intellectual transformation across the force has been happening from a counterinsurgency, counterterrorism-focused force to one that is really getting its mind wrapped around great power competition? When you were at West Point, you know, you were in that class that felt the backdraft of Vietnam. At the same time, you were refocusing to the Fold the Gap, where you found yourself in your first assignment. Do you see that kind of intellectual transformation taking place across the force?
I do. I think it's going to take some time. You know, it's interesting enough when you take a look at the leaders that we have. So for the last 19 years, the focus has been combat operations and irregular warfare, counterinsurgency, in counterterrorism operations. So that's what our officers, non-commissioned officers, and soldiers at the battalion level and below know. But we've been transforming our combat training centers. We've been transforming our schools and all of professional military education. I think our leaders understand that we're going through a transformation. Part of the talking that we're doing in multiple venues is explaining the vision for the way ahead. And so we're seeing that those changes happen. When they go to the combat training centers, they're getting a dose of large-scale ground combat operations where they're contested in every domain, so they understand that and develop the skill sets to be able to operate in that environment.
Do you have a time scale, though, for when you think this transformation, you know, is it a 2-year or 5-year thing? Because you're already instituted quite a lot of some of this foundational work, right? And some of it started under your predecessor and your predecessor's predecessor, Ray Odierno, looking at those tailored units to build those international partnerships. What kind of a year delta do you put on this before you think you get to that transformed base force?
What I see is I think we're going to start seeing transformational technologies in place in 2 to 3 years. And once those capabilities come in with the concepts we're developing, we're going to see some significant improvements in the force. And this Project Convergence is really going to increase the speed, the range, and the lethality of the force. And I think it's going to fundamentally change the way we fight and operate. And all these are coming together over the next 2 to 5 years. But I would suggest that, you know, we will incrementally improve what we have, these new systems, for the next 40 years till that new chief comes in maybe in 2060. And he talks about the last time we transformed was 2020. In these systems, the hypersonic missile system is now the Zulu model, and we probably need to come up with a new system to replace that.
I should hope that everything that we put in service, sir, will give that chief for decades downstream the kind of options that they need to maintain deterrence and also fight and win America's wars. Let me ask you about the challenge, which I think in the case of the Army is perhaps even more profound. You face the challenge of making trade-offs on what was going to be a flat to declining budget. You and I talked about that earlier this year at the Atlantic Council. Now the overall budget faces the pressure of COVID and trillions of dollars in pandemic recovery costs. And on top of that, the former Secretary of the Army, who is the current Secretary of Defense, Dr. Mark Esper, has said that the Army will have to shrink in order to help increase the size of the Navy. There are those who are making a similar case for the Air Force, certainly from a Pacific focus standpoint. That means that the force faces even more trade-offs, and the likes of which the Army hasn't faced perhaps even since the end of the Cold War. Transformation is key, obviously, to think your way through these challenges. And as you said, reinvent yourself as opposed to just doing better what you used to do. What are the priorities the Army will protect? And where do you have some trade space where you feel you can take risk? Because again, this is about thinking through this challenge and are emerging out of it stronger.
Yeah, I think, you know, well, first of all, at least from where I sit, we have some overarching principles. First of all, every person counts, every dollar counts. And, you know, so we don't have any room for excess or suboptimized utilization of resources. And so, you know, when we take a look at where our major investments are, we certainly talk about end strength. That's one. And when I look at the Army end strength, it's not even where I think it should be as far as size. When I look at the readiness is extremely good, but we've got to make sure that we can fight and win tonight. And I believe we can do that against anyone. And then when I look at modernization, I believe that we must modernize, we must transform the Army right now. So we have the overmatch that we need for the next 40 years. And so when it comes to priorities and within the modernization portfolio, the six modernization priorities and the 31 plus three systems that fall under that, those are the things that we must keep. Those are the things that we must prioritize. But having said that, those programs must meet cost performance and schedule parameters, or they are at risk also.
One of the challenges always in this is, I mean, you noted 180,000 soldiers are deployed to more than 100 countries around the world. Is that where, is the Army going to have to trade people to preserve those modernization programs that it as it has so often over the past several decades?
Well, I think what I need to do and the Secretary needs to do as the Secretary and the Chief is come back to the senior leadership if there is some type of reduction in resources and provide them the insights on what the impact is as far as our ability to support whatever strategy they have in place. You know, again, there's really three major areas for resources and strength readiness and modernization, and within those portfolios is where we provide the Army that we need to fight and win the nation's wars.
Has Dr. Esper given you any sort of cut delta at the, you know, a cut number, like, hey, this is what you're going to end up losing at the end of the day? I mean, do you have that kind of guidance yet?
No, we don't. And you know, again, we have not been given any guidance like that.
Let me ask you about this notion of mission specialization, right? There are those who are increasingly arguing that that the Navy and the Air Force, along with the Marine Corps, should be the Pacific focus force, and then actually the Army should be the centerpiece of deterring Russia, engaging in Africa and across the Middle East. I'm asking you as the Army Chief of Staff, is that a good idea? And if not, why not? If yes, why, right? What's the put and take of that as people try to figure out how to potentially do all of this with a little bit less money? And hence, right, I mean, I think that's why some folks are thinking, look, if we do this as a specialized way, we take a lot of burden off the Army.
Yeah, I think, you know, from the Army standpoint, I guess I serve two roles. I serve in the Joint Chiefs and I serve as the Army Chief of Staff. I would say I'd look at it from the Joint Chiefs perspective. And from that, I think the Army's focus should be on land. And the Army's focus should be where the highest priorities are for land. And, you know, as we, you know, because I've heard this discussion before on the Pacific. I've looked at the history of Pacific, and, you know, the Army has a long history of providing a significant amount of forces in the Pacific during World War II and during Korea and during Vietnam and some other places. So, you know, as long as there's land in the Pacific and people live on land, I think there's a significant role for the United States Army. And I would, you know, suggest that you would not want to take that option out of the hands of a combatant commander that is there, because at the end of the day, you know, when we look at competition, when we look at conflict, it really comes down to competition for the will of the people. And most of the people in that region live on the land, and many of our partners, they live on the land, our allies and partners, and I think having the ability to work with them to increase their capacities and capabilities and also to reassure them takes a land force. So I would at least suggest that that we should avoid the idea that there's no place for the Army in the Pacific.
We now are fortunate in that we have transformation-minded chiefs across each of the military services, all of which also feel the urgency, right? As you're summing it up, winning matters, just like we've heard from CQ Brown, accelerate change or lose, right? Trying to put this in stark terms that unless we get our act together very, very quickly against China and Russia, that those are going to be key to deterrence. On the one hand, that jointness has been a tremendous benefit, and the great relationship you all have amongst yourselves is fantastic. On the other hand, there are those who say that there isn't enough intellectual friction in the system today, as there was in the past, that yielded kind of leap ahead operational concepts, again, like air-land battle. How do you work this so that you move the ball jointly while at the same time driving that intellectual competition that historically has led to some of the most, the ideas that have made the most difference?
Well, I think there is a certain amount of intellectual friction that's going on right now between the services. Not that the services don't want to work together, but the services tend to optimize, you know, what they're developing for the domain that they're going to fight in. You know, if you're developing a joint all-domain command and control system for an Air Force, that may be different than what you design for a Sea Force or for a Land Force. But what we know and what we've committed to, General Brown and myself, and the Navy is very interested in what we're doing too, is try to find the common ground where we can come together, and because we're coming together, the sum of the parts is much greater as a force than if we develop our own system separately. And more importantly is, you know, if we, you know, develop, if I'm going down the VHS way and General Brown's going the beta, that we can't come together and exchange data at the speed of relevance. That's not going to be very, very helpful for the joint force. So there's enough stress and tension in bringing the forces together, bring the systems together, so that we introduce our allies and partners. That is a very significant problem set that we want to get to working beyond PowerPoint in the dirt, which we're doing right now, and it's going to change the way we fight in the future.
That notion, your former colleague, Dave Goldfein, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, was one of the big proponents of JADC2 and certainly drove that to the fore. And it's terrific that you, the Army and the Air Force, have managed to strike that agreement. But the Navy isn't part of it. Can this succeed? I mean, first, why isn't the Navy part of it? Because there has been a little bit of reticence on the Navy's part. There are some who have suggested that the Navy doesn't quite know exactly how best to stitch its architecture with that of the other services. Why isn't the Navy part of this effort? And can it succeed with the Navy not being part of it, given the centrality of its role, for example, in the Pacific?
No, I think the Navy's very interested in being part of the solution. We're all part of joint all domain operations. I mean, that's going to be the joint warfighting concept. And, you know, as far as the Navy actually participating in this, they are observing, they are going to come part of this, and they want to make sure they understand what we're doing. We're working very closely with the Navy on multiple fronts, from hypersonics to some mid-range missile systems. And we're all trying to make sure we understand how these systems are going to pass data, so we get the convergence that we need to get the range, the speed, and the lethality we need in the future force.
At a time when the Army is increasing its fires, or hopes to increase its fires, to ranges where the Air Force would be, right? I mean, that's more of an Air Force range. Hypersonics blurs those lines entirely. If you look at air defense, the United States Army barely has enough air defense for its own needs, much less the needs of the Air Force, for example. I know that you guys have had that conversation at a very senior level. Do we need another Key West to relook at some of these edges and boundaries, given where new technology is going to be taking us in terms of what is deep strike, what is not deep strike, how you add cyber to that equation? And then again, how do you reconsider air defense, which people have a tendency of looking toward the Army to provide, and the Navy, obviously, to provide for itself? Where do you stand on that? And where do the other chiefs stand on it?
Well, you know, we haven't addressed a Key West, but I think what we're, you know, taking a look at is how do we bring the capabilities that we have to the future battlefield? And we know there has to be integration. We know there has to be synchronization. But the other value of convergence is we can do things in you know, what we call battle space, in ways that we never considered before. You know, I mean, we have aviation within the Army to support our soldiers on the ground. And what's interesting is, as we get greater technology, you know, we would have what we call air routes for aircraft to going into near an objective. And we never had the technology to really know where the aircraft exactly were, or have that capability to open and close air routes at the speed of relevance. So many times we'd just close down fire support areas, a place we wanted to shoot artillery or we wanted to move aircraft. We weren't able to synchronize it the way we can in the future. But now, with the technology we have, we're going to be able to fundamentally change the way we do airspace. And you know, even if you look at a long-range precision strike, the fact that you have sensors, the fact that you have the ability to know where a system is, it gives you much greater capability to operate in that environment. And I think as we look at the future, we should not be tied to the past. We shouldn't be linear. We may have to think about how we operate in a different method. And I think that's what will come out of this as we do experimentation, as we do simulation, as we work to develop these concepts in a joint, all-domain way.
How large do you think, how many years does the United States have, given at the rate at which the Chinese and Russian militaries are improving their capabilities, as you guys consider what your windows are? Is it a two-year window where we need to sort of get better at what we're doing? Is it a four-year window? How do you guys look at that? And what's the thing that keeps you up at night when you think about this future?
Well, I look at, first of all, I think it's years, it's not decades. So I think we need to get on this. I think we have the opportunity right now. I've been very clear on, I think the time is now to transform the Army, and we need to do it over the next 2 to 5 years. And so at least have it going in the way we want to start delivering the programs that we have. And again, many of our programs are on schedule to be delivered in the next 3 to 5 years. So I think that's very, very important. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, always people like to ask what keeps you up at night. I like to say I sleep well at night because I serve with the world's greatest soldiers. But having said that, you know, I mean, the existential threat to the United States is nuclear weapons at the end of the day. And so, you know, that's something that we certainly need to be very concerned about. You know, great power competition does not necessarily mean great power conflict. I believe in kind of President Reagan philosophy that there is peace through strength. And that's why I think the country needs to invest in a strong military so we never have to get to any type of conflict. And a great power conflict or a great power war would be horrific.
Let me take you two more questions in the brief time we've got left. Your talent management strategy has been very, very visionary and very forward-leaning. To get the diversity you want, intellectually, racially, politically, demographically, you've said the Army's going to compete not just, for example, in the South, but also in big cities in the North. You're proud of your roots in Quincy, Massachusetts. But that's a goal that will take decades, right, to realize. Do you have any indicators on how you're moving the needle or whether you're moving the needle as much as you need to move it?
No, I don't see it decades. I see it over the next 2 or 3 years. And the reason I say this is what we are doing in the United States Army is moving from what I would call an industrial age system where everyone is treated like an interchangeable part into a 21st century talent management system where we actively compete for talent. We actively compete for diversity. And we have the ability to recognize soldiers for their knowledge, skills, behavior, and even preferences, which is somewhat interesting in the United States Army. And by doing that, we can get them in the right job at the right place. And as our integrated personnel and pay system comes on, we can even incentivize them to do that because we're going to need multiple talents in the future. We're going to need to be a diverse and quite frankly, not just diversity to me, it's just statistics. I'm more interested in inclusion and belonging in the organization. But we need to compete for all the talent in the United States. And that's what we're doing. The feedback we're getting back from a lot of the processes that we're putting in place, they're working. And we think these are very, very important for the future.
Last question. This is a very chaotic time in America's history. There's political discord, continuing fight for social justice. You've made it clear that the Army has led throughout its history and it'll lead here as well. What do you tell soldiers when, you know, they, you know, I've never heard more talk about the importance of leadership and character than I have over the last couple of years. What do you tell soldiers when they ask you about these issues, and what's the Army's role in society as a character model? Because you've been so proud of, you know, talking about the importance of integrity and leadership and character.
Yeah, you know, people, you know, often ask me, well, so what makes a good leader? Well, it starts with character, because character is all about having leaders that you can trust, and you've got to be able to trust your leaders, and you got to be able to trust your leaders that they're going to do the right, not only the right thing, but do the right thing the right way. And that's extremely important. You know, we need leaders that are competent, that know their job. We need leaders that are committed, that are willing to, you know, demonstrate the commitment to an organization. And the last thing is we need leaders that care, that have empathy, that care about their people. And those are the four things that I'm looking for in the senior leaders of the United States Army. And that's what I think the American people should look for too. We need to stay out of politics. You know, our job is to protect the nation, and that's what we need to do. And I'm not a Republican general or a Democrat general. I'm an American general, and that's where we need to stay.
Thanks very, very much, General McConville. It's always an honor and pleasure talking to you. We appreciate it very, very much. And you know, best of luck in the last 2 days of AUSA. Is it going as well as you'd hoped?
It's going very well. Ideally, I always like to do things like this in person, where you can, you know, shake hands and you look people in the eye. But at the same time, by going virtual, there's a lot of people that are getting a chance to participate that may have not been able to come to DC. So there's goods and bads, and I'm an optimist, so I'm looking at the goods.
Terrific, sir. Thanks very much. Glad you're healthy, and look forward to seeing you in person sooner than later.
Okay, take care, Viola. Great talking to you.
Yes, sir. Thanks again.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.